This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Start another one. So it's a text and image thing, like comics. It's probably the first place where text and image was combined before the invention of print, you know, in the theater. The actor walks out onto the stage, forms a stage picture, and then opens his mouth, and there's the text. So it's comics are definitely in that tradition.
What is it about the opera form that appeals to you? Is there a formalism that...
Music theater. Yeah, I think there's a music to human speech that we're not always conscious of in spoken language. And I like when someone can just crank it up another 10 or 20%. So you say, wait a minute, that person is singing. He's not just talking. And it's this kind of, again, a kind of very heightened, you're very self-conscious about the theatrics of the thing or the artificiality of the whole construct. That's what I like about it.
And there's definitely something theatrical about your comics. I remember many, many years ago seeing your weekly comic strip, Julius Knippel, Real Estate Photographer, in the alternative newspapers. And it was almost a throwback. You use pencil and pen and watercolor washes. And there's a very, as we were saying, a very theatrical action. Some readers characterize your comics as wordy. There's certainly no shortage of dialogue and narration. Characters often narrate the action. But I notice in your strips there's also a formality and a cadence to the language. To me, it's like David Mamet meets the Old Testament Psalms.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's why I'm drawn to these multimedia forms. I love how language corrects what you're seeing with your eyes. I mean, you can't see the whole picture just by looking. You need this commentary. And, conversely, text and words are kind of meaningless if they're not anchored in some concrete reality. They're just verbiage. So it's how storytelling works. You're watching the storyteller as they deliver their words, and that's how theater works, and that's how film works, and that's how comics work. So they're not one of these purified disciplines like painting or text prose.
One thing that strikes me about your characters is when they're narrating their own actions, when they're narrating the things around them, you know, it seems like a very self-conscious kind of milieu. I remember the early Doonesbury strips, the characters would always narrate their actions as if they were the hero of their own adventures.
Yeah, I mean, I think that goes back to a Brechtian theatrical device.
Bertolt Brecht?
Yeah, and he got it from picture recitation. People who would be telling the story while they're an actor in the story, and that kind of presentational device where you're not trying to lull the reader or viewer into believing this is a kind of reality. It's a very artificial construct, so you don't want the viewer to fall into this kind of trance. You want them to constantly be aware that they're watching a theatrical construct. And that's one way to do it.
Right. You said you're inspired by the stage. And so in some sense, your settings are almost like sets.
Yeah. One of the functions of a picture story is that you can deal with spatial drama. That's something you can't deal with in words, because words can approximate a spatial description, but they're not concrete spatial descriptions. And that's something pictures are just perfect for. So I like to build the drama around the space of the place the event is taking place in.
Well, the book Hand Drawing in America and Other Stories, there's a lot of love letters to architecture and to structures that things that are part of architecture that are sensory, that have heft and you can touch them. You know, they're not virtual things, but...
Well, it's a strip that runs in the back page of an architecture and design magazine called Metropolis. It's an ongoing strip. You can read it online or in print. And it's a magazine about that built world. And my strip at the end of the magazine is usually the commentary of the user of the built world. Not necessarily the maker, but the user.
You know, there was a movie that came out a few years ago called The Royal Tenenbaums with Gene Hackman and Angelica Houston. And to me, the most remarkable thing about the film was this oddly archaic version of New York that was all around the characters. Wes Anderson, the director, created a sort of parallel Manhattan that didn't have any cell phones or billboards or fax machines. And all the cars were old and battered. This seemed like a New York that your character, Julius Knipple, might be comfortable in, or even a Damon Runyon character.
Well, yeah, Knipple was supposed to take place just before my birth. So I was looking back at the history of New York and, you know, the city that I discovered as a given when I was born. And I think the strips in Metropolis are much more about the world that I live in. So I'd say there's a kind of a different emphasis.
Well, there's a more contemporary look in Hand Drawing in America, the strips, the book that's out now. But there's still something very similar to your early strips, the Julius Knipple strips, and that's this meshing of the familiar and the absurd. You have all of these settings, these streets of New York with their old shops and these great edifice buildings, but there are elements inside there that are mysterious, ineffable, some elements that couldn't really exist.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the city is just a collection of these crackpot ideas that were materialized. I mean, most ideas that people have never find physical realization in the world. They remain ideas. Most architecture remains on paper. And that's something that I'm highly conscious of, and that's sort of a great theme of the book. There could be other worlds. This is just one of many worlds, and I don't know if it's the best of all possible worlds, but it's, you know, the one that was pushed and bullied into existence. So I think that's something you should come away with when you read the strip. You should feel like, well, wait a minute, why does American money have to be this dull green color? Why can it be another color? And, you know, and so on. You could question everything about the world, the physical world.
Right. I certainly don't want to discourage any of our West Coast listeners from picking up your books because they're not provincial New York kind of settings or stories.
Yeah, no, and I rarely set the story in New York because I want to invent my own city each time I start the strip. So it's kind of a mythology of late capitalist cities in America. It's not New York, but very rarely do I mention an actual place in New York. So it's this mythology of how cities were set up in the 19th and 20th century.
Well, what fascinates you about architecture? Not only the bones of a building, but you're also fascinated by the inner workings, sort of the guts of buildings, and all of the filigree, all the things that people take for granted, nobody thinks too hard about. You go in there and you highlight these elements.
Yeah, I think, you know, what sometimes looks like the minutiae of urban design is a very similar impulse to a scientist that wants to look at things on a molecular structure. So I say that by looking at the minutiae of the way things were built and designed, like what is that sound we hear when we flip a light switch? I mean, why that sound? Is it just a mechanical accident, or is there a purpose behind it? And if there was no purpose behind it, how does it color our lives? And if you look at those small aspects of the built world, you can then extrapolate into the largest structures of why are things the way they are. So, yeah, it's just a kind of scientific examination in that sense. I go down to the microscopic, and then I can pull back and say, well, you see, that's why we are the way we are.
The book that's out now, Hand Drawing in America, seems to be the most political of your comic collections. I don't think of it so much as electoral politics, but as societal politics.
Yeah. I mean, somebody picks up an overtly left-wing political tract. If they don't agree with it, they probably won't even read it. So there has to be a more subtle way of getting to people and sort of approaching them just as a human being and saying, you know, what are you doing? How are you behaving? How is that sound of that light switch affecting you? And, you know, once they get through the strip, they'll have this realization, this revelation, and that they wouldn't have it if they read it and knew this is a strip making mockery of the Republican Party. They're not going to get that far. So it's my own subversive technique.
You've had 5 other collections of strips.
Yeah. You know, the other strips have their own kind of agenda. The Jew of New York is about the invention of the whole market economy. Knipple, I guess, is about the death of that whole economy, what's become of it, you know, in the kind of world I was born into. So
the garment district and
yes.
The...
Why is there no garment district? Why can't we afford to make clothing, you know, in New York City anymore?
I think the jewelry district is still around, isn't it?
Things are made there. I mean, jewelry, high-end rings and things. But I think costume jewelry is probably all made overseas.
Yeah, if you ever manage to make it back to Portland, there's a lot of wonderful archaic things in this town. We have a remote neighborhood of St. John's, which until a few years ago, it boasted not one, but 2 typewriter repair shops. I think that would be another place where Julius Knipple would be very much at home.
Yeah, I mean, things like that, I think, survive in less expensive cities. A lot of those things are gone from New York, that's for sure. And that's just a matter of rent, you know, rental costs, things like that. But, you know, it's a strange thing to be making comics. It's the last kind, it's like making handmade shoes or something. I mean, there's no economic logic behind it. Spending so much time making things. Most people would look at it and say, what are you, you're crazy. How can you make a living doing this?
And yet you keep on doing it.
Yeah. I mean, I teach now, and that subsidizes some of it. I do other things, theater. But, you know, if I wanted to just make comics as quickly and as cheaply as possible, they wouldn't be like the comics I make. They'd be very different comics. So there's some lesson to be learned.
You're listening to Words and Pictures on KBOO. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. My guest today on the phone from Seattle is acclaimed alternative cartoonist and graphic novelist Ben Katcher. His latest book is Hand Drawing in America and Other Stories. And I don't think you'll be offended if I say that your comic strips, Julius Knipple, The Jew of New York, The Cardboard Valise, Hotel and Farm, Shoehorn Technique, that all of these are really acquired tastes. I mean, I'd really love listeners to pick up some of your books and give it a little bit of time.
Yes.
Not just look at the first strip, but shuffle through the pages and get the rhythm and the cadence and the formality and the staginess of everything.
Yeah. Sometimes it helps to hear me read them. So you can go online now and hear readings and hear how they're presented just as verbal poetry, and then you can connect that to the pictures. But, you know, it's a strange thing. People come to comics for as many reasons as people come to film. And, you know, since 1939, a lot of comic book production in America has been toward superheroes and other genre work. You know, and to a lot of people, that's what comics are. And if you say, no, this is a comic strip about an analysis of the built world or of architecture, they'll say, well, that's not the kind of comics I want to read. So forms get very confused with their subject matter, and I think that's really happened in comics. That's why comics had such a bad name through the 50s and 60s. They were associated with the content. You know, most novels are terrible gothic romances. Most movies are junk. I mean, we can't stop looking at forms because of the content we see. The form itself has a kind of neutrality. It's, you know, you can make of it what you want. In comics, it happens to be a multimedia form, and so it's open to a lot of possibilities.
Well, the content of hand drawing in America is, there's a lot of strips about architecture, and I'm wondering, there seems to be an architecture to the comic strip itself, or to the comic page, to the way that readers take in a comic strip. You know, there's probably as much experimentation with the way comics are laid out, especially in the digital age, as there ever was with architectural styles.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's the idea of a diagrammatic comic strip, meaning a multiple-panel comic strip, opens itself up to that, the simultaneous reading of time. You can see the beginning and the middle and the end at one glance as a diagram. A lot of the strips in Metropolis revolve around the central image, which is sort of the image you come away with after you've put the book away, the strip away, to say this is the central image, and then the smaller images are subordinate to that image. That's kind of the design approach I have to the diagrammatic page. If I had 8 pages in Metropolis, I do an 8-page strip with a very different kind of layout. So there's a whole socioeconomic determination to comic strips. You know, it's part of a magazine or it's a little piece of a newspaper page. We don't have all the room in the world. The trade-off is you work with those constrictions, but you have an audience and you get paid. And that seems like a fair trade-off.
Well, in the end papers of Hand Drawing in America, just inside the covers, the front and back covers, there are some very interesting strips about the self-consciousness of publishing a large-scale art book, all of the process that goes into the manufacture and the shipping and the putting together of a book like this really large-scale hardcover that you've put
out.
Yeah,
I mean, it had to be, I mean, for it to be published by a major publisher and have any chance of recouping the cost, it had to be made in China. I did the drawings in America, but that's about it. So nothing else. And that's because on an hourly wage, I probably make, you know, a penny an hour doing a comic strip. I'm not making American minimum wage. It takes me hundreds of hours to work on these strips, to think of them and write them. So I'm not in this economy. Pantheon and Random House are trying to function in the real economy, the American economy, and so they have to ship all this printing to China. Kind of a strange thing. I mean, I'm sure they could get Chinese cartoonists somewhere who would work for less than I work. But they, you know, they need people, I guess, who can talk to an American reading public. I don't know. But it's a very interesting time in the history of media and publishing. It's kind of a turning point in the whole history of what do we even see, you know, what kind of works get seen and how do they get seen, and what the whole publishing landscape will be in the next few years. It's a good question.
I'd like to ask you about a lecture that you did not too long ago. It was called The Great Museum Cafeterias of the Western World.
Yeah.
An illustrated lecture on the design and culture of museum cafeterias.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time as an art student in museum cafeterias. So I would always visit them when I went to a museum.
It seems to me that this is another part of our culture that's changing. When I was a kid, I'd go into the Art Institute of Chicago, someplace like that, and there'd be a cafeteria where you could buy something for a couple of bucks. And so many museums have ripped out those little cafeterias and replaced them with these expensive restaurants that cater to upscale clients.
Yeah, well, I think they want the eating experience to rival the art. And so the art, I mean, some museums are showing the most valuable objects that exist in the world. And so they thought it was kind of strange to have a cheap cafeteria serving food in the context of those works of art. I mean, that's kind of what happened. So in many cities in America, the best restaurant in town happens to be in the art museum, or the most upscale, you know, from a culinary point of view. But that's, you know, that's in the last 15 or 20 years.
Well, back in the day, you know, back when we had this thriving middle class, and you'd expect the lumpen to come into these museums, they're free or they're cheap.
Right.
Tell us about the design and the culture of the mid-century, of the 20th century museum cafeteria.
Oh, what were they like? The cheapest way that you could feed people, you know, and not have them get food on the paintings. So they were segregated from the galleries. And they were kind of an afterthought. They were a necessity. People didn't want to have to leave the building to eat. And they started putting tea rooms and little cafeterias into museums, partly for the employees, partly for the visitors. And they were pretty bare bones, you know, even in these great European museums, the Victoria and Albert. They were geared towards students and scholars, the people who were in museums, not somebody looking for an expensive dinner. So that's the difference, I think.
Do you think that's been part of the reason why so-called high culture seems more off-putting to people nowadays, to the average person?
Well, I don't know. High culture, you mean in the art world? Well, it's very wrapped up with fashion and with affluence. And the reason people, in New York, it's very wrapped up with real estate. If you show a work of art in a 10,000 square foot space in lower Manhattan, that means there's a lot of money and power behind that exhibition. You just need the money to show things. So, yeah, that's why I became a cartoonist. I studied painting and I said, this is not the world for me. I purposely decided not to be in the gallery world or the art world. That world kind of has a vague interest in cartoonists. I've had shows in that world, but it's not really my kind of thing.
Well, the book is Hand Drawing in America and Other Stories. The author is Ben Katcher. You can find his picture stories in such publications as The Forward, Metropolis Magazine, The New York Times, The New Yorker, and his serialized strips appear in any number of books. You've been listening to Words and Pictures today. I'm S.W. Konser, and I've been delighted to be joined by award-winning alternative cartoonist and graphic novelist Ben Catcher. Ben, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. There are not many radio shows about comics. I mean, you have the field all sewn up at the moment.
Well, we're delighted that you joined us on ours, and so we'd like to thank you. And listeners can check out some videos of your recitations on your website. That's catchor.com. How do you spell your name?
K-A-T-C-H-O-R.
K-A-T-C-H-O-R.com?
Yeah. And, you know, you just do a Google search, you'll find all kinds of videos. I think there's an old TED Talk where I did a reading.
And listeners can also find out more about your books. Your books include Cheap Novelties, The Pleasures of Urban Decay, Julius Knipple, Real Estate Photographer, The Jew of New York, The Beauty Supply District, The Cardboard Valise, and the latest one, Hand Drawing in America, and other stories.
Right.
We'd like to thank all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. And an archived version of today's show will be available later on our archive page, kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. Now stay tuned for an afternoon of music on your artisanal Portland radio station.
This is KBOO Portland.
Bagumba, cuchucumba, bagumba, a mí me gusta la rumba. Saca la lengua, María, saca la lengua. O masa, yo no sé lo que me pasa, que siento tanta alegría. Cuchucumba, bagumba, cuchucumba, bagumba, cuchucumba, bagumba, a mí me gusta la rumba. Tú tienes la lengua larga y yo la tengo chiquita. Si tú la tienes muy grande, yo te daré pica, pica. Cuchucumban, bagumba, cuchucumban, bagumba, cuchucumban, bagumba, a mí me gusta la rumba. Bagumba, cuchucumba, bagumba, a mí me gusta la rumba. Cuchucumba, bagumba, cuchucumba, bagumba, cuchucumba, bagumba, a mí me gusta la rumba.
And you're tuned to Community Radio, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM, Hood River and the Gorge, 100.7 FM, Corvallis and Albany. And we are at K220HR, Hood River, and K264AA, Corvallis. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout. Specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. And this KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at our carbon-neutral eco brew pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver. Available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia. Information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com.